The Midrash tells us that when Hashem created Adam, he invested tremendous wisdom and understanding into man. Wisdom that exceeded any other creation. Wisdom that made the Malachim, the cerebral angels, tremble. And to demonstrate that wisdom, Hashem gave man a challenge. Name each of the animals in creation. And the Mefarshim explained that naming the animals was not just a casual expression of a title. What Adam HaRishon was being asked to do was define the essence of each animal, define the inclination, the temperament, the nature of the animal, give it one title that defines it, puts it all together. And flawlessly, Adam went through every animal in the wild kingdom, Zuchamar, Zushar, Zugamal. He gave the exact title that defined the essence and nature of each one. And then he gave a name to himself, and then he gave a name to his wife. And the pasuk describes when he named his wife, Vayikra Adam Shem Leishto. Man gave a name to his wife, Chava. Why did he give the name Chava to his wife? Ki hi haisa em kochai. Because she was the mother of all future humans, the mother of the human race. Therefore, he called her Chava. And the Baal HaTurim explains, what does Chava mean? Explains the Baal HaTurim, Chava is from the expression of speech. He called her talker. And explains the Baal HaTurim, that's what the Gemara says, that there were 10 measures of speech given to the world. 9 were taken by women. Men took the other 10th. 9 measures of speech were taken by women. Adam called his wife Chava, talker, because that was her essence, that was her nature. And if you think about this Baal HaTurim, it's quite difficult to understand. Number one, it doesn't sound very complimentary. Talker. Doesn't sound like a nice way to give a title to your wife. But number two, it's very difficult to understand. What the pasuk is saying is that Adam called his wife talker because she was the mother to all creation. It is true that Hashem gave nature to a woman to be more talkative. But therefore what? That's A, not the essence of who she is. That doesn't define her. And B, why is that the reason? Because of that, she is the mother of all future children. She's the mother of the human race. Talker, A, doesn't define her, and B, it's not the reason why she's the mother, it's not the essence of her, and it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And to understand a little bit this Baal HaTurim, we have to focus on how Hashem created the human, how Hashem created man, how Hashem created woman, and when we do that, we'll get a much clearer understanding of their roles and their essences. There's a very well-known pasuk that every chassan reads before he gets involved in shidduchim and going out. The Omer Shem Lokim, Hashem said, Lo tov eyos adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. Eselo ezer kenegdo. I'll make for him a helpmate to be with him. And many young fellows, when they're preparing to get married, they say to themselves, wow, this is going to be great. A maidservant, what could be better? A Polynesian maid at my beck and call, at my service. My wish is her command. This is going to be great. And then he gets married. And he discovers that that's not quite how things are. And the Maral, the Guru Arye, explains that this fellow made a very, very simple mistake. He read half of the definition. You see, Hashem said, Lo tov yosa adam levado, it's not good for man to be alone. Eslo ezer kenegdo, a helpmate opposite him. Explains the Maral, opposite has two meanings. Opposite can mean directly in front. Explains the Maral, that's one meaning of it. She is an ezer kenegdo, a helpmate opposite, directly on the same level as him. Because the woman is important and equal to the man. She's not subservient. She's not a maidservant. She's not a slave. Ezer kenegdo, a helpmate opposite, on the same level as Chashuv, man's equal. And that explains Maral is one explanation of opposite. However, he explains that there's another explanation of opposite that's equally significant. He says, Zachar and Keva, the male and the female, Hashneim Hapchim, are both opposite one the other. Zez Zachar v'zeh Nekeva. This is male and this is Nekeva. Explains the Maral, the other definition of opposite is opposite, as in the exact antithesis. Let's play a game. I'll say a word, you tell me the opposite. If I say black, the opposite of black is white. In, opposite, out. Up, down. Male, female. As in, the male and the female are not similar, not even close. They're the opposite one of the other. Says Hashem, I'm going to make an Ezer Kenegdo, a helpmate who is his exact antithesis, total opposite. And therefore, explains the Maral, that's what you have to understand, that it's a nes when a man and a woman get along. When Hashem is in the marriage, then there's peace. But if Hashem is not in the marriage, then they go back to their natural state, and man and woman are opposites. They're two repelling forces. And without Hashem in the equation, they will literally fight one against the other. Explains Maral, that's what Rashi says. Rashi quotes over the famous Gemara, Im Zacha. If a man merits, then she'll be an Ezer, she'll be a helpmate. Im Lo Zacha, if he doesn't merit, Kenegdo, she'll be opposing him. Rashi says the words, Lelochim, to fight. And what the Maral is explaining to us is that when Hashem is there in the marriage, Hashem makes peace, and they get together, and they join together in oneness. But if not, then they're opposing. And the difficulty is, it's not one subservient to the other. If one were the boss and the other one had to obey, even if they were opposite, and even if they didn't get along, the union could continue. I'm in charge here, you listen to me. But they're not. They're shkulim, they're equal. Ezer Kenegdo means two things. Number one, she's on your level. She's your equal. She's not subservient. You're not dominant. It's two equal partners in this marriage. And number two, her nature is vastly different than yours. The opposite of yours. If Hashem is in the marriage, then in fact, there's peace. They join together. If not, it is a very, very ugly scene. And I think what this Gur Aryeh is sharing with us is a number of very significant concepts. Number one, women's liberation was needed in a secular world. For millennium, women were considered chattel. Women were considered objects to be owned, to be purchased, to be sold, to be, if they service me, fine, as a subservient sort of being. Therefore, in Western society, there needed to be a women's liberation. They needed to give women rights. They needed to make women equal. That concept was never a part of a Torah society. A woman is equal to the man. And anyone who says she's subservient, she's lower, doesn't understand the relationship. Ezer Kenegdo means a helpmate, equal as Choshev, on the same level as a man. But here's the point. Equal partners with different roles. His nature, her nature, his temperament, her temperament, but they're very, very different. And again, what the Maral is teaching us is that when they're at peace, when Hashem is in the marriage, and Hashem joins them together, then each serves their role properly, and their shalom, it's wonderful. But if not, because they're opposites and they're equal, it is Gehenim, there's fire. And I think there's a very real step that we have to focus on that will help us understand this a little bit better. The Gemara in Sotah explains that when the Jews were in Mitzrayim, initially, when the Shibud began, when the enslavement began, the Pasuk says, "Es kol avodos ha-mesh'avdu behem b'porach." The Mitzrayim made the Jews work, but not just work, beforech, they made them work in a torturous manner. What the Mitzrim did wasn't just enslave the Jewish people. They specifically intended to break the spirit. They gave them work that would be very, very difficult for them. What does that mean? One pshat is that they switched around the work. Rabbi Yochanan says they used to give the men the work of the women, and the women the work of the men. By switching the roles, they tortured them. The work was befarach, was with tremendous, tremendous pain. And Rav Friedlander asks a very interesting question. He says, I understand if you give a woman a man's job, that's torture. Listen, the men had back-breaking labor to perform, lifting heavy stones, chiseling rocks, standing all day in the hot sun, cementing bricks. A woman doesn't have the same physicality, doesn't have the same muscularity, and I understand why it would be torturous to her to give her that kind of job. So that part makes sense. But why is it torturous to give a man a woman's job? It's rather easy. What does she do? Cook, clean, mend, iron. For a strong man who's used to working in the field all day, that should be a vacation. He takes it easy. All he's got to do is just relax. Why is that oppressive? And explains for Friedlander, because exactly that point. Hashem gave a different nature, a different temperament, different inclinations to a man and to a woman. And Hashem gave them very specific temperaments for their role in life. A woman has a very unique nature, and a man has a very unique nature. When men are out there in the field, when they're lifting heavy rocks, when they're chiseling away, their nature suits that work suits them, and there's a sense of contentment, a sense of harmony. But when you give a man a woman's labor, when you make him do the cooking and the cleaning, the type of things that don't suit his nature, it's torturous. Why? Because it doesn't fit him. There's a sense of disharmony. There's a sense of being tormented because Hashem gave a very specific nature to each so that they should be able to do their role in a very exact, successful manner. And this yesod, that they're equal partners with different roles, is a fundamental to a successful marriage and something that most of Western society, for most of history, and including now, miss completely. And let's focus on what those different roles are. A woman is known as the Akeres Habayis, the support, the main support of the house. The role of the woman as the wife, as the mother, is to nurture, cultivate, support, to care. Some women assume that their role is to cook and clean and do laundry. And I'd like to share with you, whilst that may be a small part of a woman's role, it's exactly that, a small part. When my kids were little, over and over, I said to my wife, we have to buy as much cleaning help as we possibly can. And I would tell her, I want you to buy takeout food for Shabbos. And my wife would say, what do you mean? Isn't it a mitzvah to bake challahs for Shabbos? Don't you want me to do that? And I said to her, yes, I would like that. But it's far more important to our family for you to be on the floor with our kids playing than it is to be in the kitchen baking. Mitzvah Hashem, there'll be a time when the kids will be grown up and you'll have time. Then you want to bake challah, it's fine. But I'll be mochel every day of the week. All of the baking and all of the cooking and all of the cleaning. Because the main role of a woman is to be a mother, to be with her children, to nurture them, to care for them, to cultivate them, to give them the emotional support, to be with them. And while there are many, many roles that a woman plays, she is the Akeres Habayis, the bastion of the house. She's the pillar of the house. Her main role is involved in the relationships and bringing up the children, being a support for a husband, emotionally there, caring, nurturing. And if you think about this point, you'll understand much of what's wrong in Western society. What is it that a child needs more than anything else? A child obviously has many needs. Food, drink, clothing, schooling, many, many needs. But if you'd like to understand at the core of the child's essence, what does he need more than anything else, let's look at some interesting experiments that psychologists, scientists performed long ago. They would take infant monkeys and put them in a cage without anything. No mother, no siblings, nothing. And they let them grow up. There was food in the cage, there was water. And these infant monkeys grew up into juvenile monkeys. And then they would introduce these juvenile monkeys, or now young adult monkeys, back into the group. And what they found was that these monkeys who had grown up in isolation were hostile, could not integrate into the normal society of monkeys, could not be a member of any clan, any group, troop of monkeys, and they were destined to die a bitter young age. Because what had happened was the monkey had no socialization, wasn't normal, couldn't function. And if you would like to hear a kavahomer, ben benosha kavahomer, look at a child. The biggest need that a child has is to be a part of a home, to be loved, to be supported, to be nurtured, to be understood. Yes, a child has many physical needs. Yes, a child has many social needs. The primary need that a child has, probably more than anything else, is his mother's love and support. And when a child has that, the child thrives. And if the child doesn't have that, it is a very, very rough situation. I hate to quote Sigmund Freud, but there's one line that is worth repeating in his name. He would say that if by the age of 5 a child knows that he is the apple of his mother's eye, he will be well adjusted. And that point is very profound. If a child knows that he or she is the center of his mother's life, that he has full, absolute attention from his mother, that he matters to his mother, that she's there for him, that child will be well adjusted. Will that child be the most successful person in the world? I don't know. Each child has a different temperament, different talent, but that child will be well adjusted. And when we see so many children today who are so unwholesome, you have to ask yourself, I wonder if there's any connection between the amount of time that mothers spend with their children and their wholesomeness and their sense of self. In the ancient times, as in the 1950s, a mother's role was clearly defined to be a wife, a mother of her children, to be there with the child, to be there helping, involved as a nurturing, caring, loving mother. The child knew his mother, mother knew the child, and they were bonded together. And even as the child grew up and went to school, in the morning his mother was there with plenty of time, plenty of patience, plenty of attention to him or to her, because that was the mother's main tafkid, main task. And when that child came home from school, guess what? Mom was waiting. And when you grow up in a world where your mother is there, involved in your life, caring, nurturing, well, guess what? As a human being, you know that you're whole, you develop normal relationships, and you develop a normal sense of self. And if you'd like to know, arguably, what is the main role of a woman in a marriage, in a family, it is what I would call the relationship manager. The main role of the woman is to be the one there for her husband, there for her children, involved in their lives, the support. Does she do many things? Yes, a mother for sure does a myriad, 10,000 different things. Some of them can be outsourced. And certainly when your kids are little, it is a wise idea to outsource them. I was in South Africa last year, and every from home there has at least 2 people who are there at their beck and call, cleaning, cooking, Labor there is very, very inexpensive, extremely inexpensive. And every frum house has at least two people who serve as cooks, clean, whatever it may be. When I left the minyan in the morning and I came back maybe 2 hours later, my shirt that I had worn the day before was cleaned and pressed. And by and large, in the frum community there, the women don't cook and don't clean. So you may say, oh my goodness, they don't do anything. Not a Jewish woman. She doesn't cook because there's a woman there who cooks. She doesn't clean because a woman. So what does she do? She's not a wife. She's not a mother, right? Wrong. You know what she does? She cares for her husband and cares for her children. She dedicates herself to the well-being, the success, the development of her children. She dedicates herself to the well-being of her husband. She is the relationship manager of the family. She's the one who cares. She's the one who nurtures. She's the one who is the akeres habayis, not a cook or a maid servant or a efficient shopper, but the one who provides the necessary ingredients, the love, the attention, the balance in a family. In our world, a woman is forced to do many, many other things, some of them that she probably shouldn't be doing, like working. But unfortunately, the reality is such, economic conditions are such, that in most families, that's also a reality. But it's important to understand, at least in theory, what the main role of a woman is, and that's to be involved in the lives of her children, of her husband, to be the one who keeps everything together, maintained, and developed. Now, one more step, and I think we'll be able to understand, is Balat Urim. All relationships that human beings engaged in are based on one thing, communication. All social connections are created, maintained, developed by conversation, by communicating. The way we human beings create friendships, the way we maintain them, the way we develop them, is by speaking. We converse, we communicate. My feelings, my thoughts, your thoughts. The single method by which all relationships are developed and maintained are by speaking. And I believe that's exactly what the Balat Urim is saying. You know why Adam defined his wife as Chava, as talker? Because her role is to be the Akeres Habayis. She's the one who's responsible for all the relationships, for her husband's emotional, psychological well-being, for the children's development. How does she do that? She does it because Hashem gave her a nature to be a talker, to be one who speaks, because speech is the method via which you create relationships, you maintain relationships, you repair relationships. It's not by accident that women are talkative. It's not like, that's strange, and it's women. Hashem gave a woman a nature to be a talker because that's the way you create relationships, the way you maintain them, the way you develop them. And what Adam was doing was defining the very nature of woman that Hashem gave to woman so that she could play her role as the one responsible for her household. How does a woman do that? By maintaining the relationships, by maintaining everything in the house, as a husband being supported, as children being supported. That is her role. And I believe that this Balat Urim is fundamental to understanding a woman's role and a man's role, and B, one of the great difficulties in marriage. And that is a certain reality. The reality is that men and women are different. But as the Maharal told us, not casually different, not difference in certain characteristics or circumstances, opposites, complete, total opposites. And there's probably no greater indication of the difference between men and women than in the language that they speak. And if you're not sure what I mean, go to a house Shabbos afternoon. In one room, maybe you'll see the men speaking. The other room, you'll see the women. And just listen as an anthropologist would listen. Don't listen to the words. Listen to the tone. Listen to the beat. Listen to the banter. And you'll see it's very, very different. The women speak in a very different way than do men. And if you focus in, you'll notice a whole different tonality and a whole different back and forth. Whenever a woman says something, a woman next to her says, oh, I see. I understand. That's interesting. And then when she speaks, the woman next to her says something back also. Oh, I see. And if you look at men, you hear a very different situation. One man speaks, another one stands there in stone silence. Then the other man speaks, and the other one sits there in stone silence. One speaks, the other listens. One speaks, and the other listens. And there's a very real difference, not just in the way they speak, but in what we'll call the listening noises. And I'd like to focus on why this is. Men and women, by and large, speak for vastly different reasons. By and large, women speak to create and develop a relationship. They share things. They express themselves. They do that because they want to share themselves. They want to get support from their friend. They want their friend's support. And when their friends speak, they want to support her back. So when two women speak one to the other, you'll hear exactly that. She'll speak about things that happened to her, things that he said and she said and happened. And a friend who wants to support her as she expresses her inner thoughts and feelings will say, oh, really? Because a friend is telling her something. I'm listening. I'm supporting you. I want to hear more. When men speak, they speak for a different reason altogether. Men don't speak to create a relationship. They don't speak to share their emotional world. Men speak to communicate ideas, concepts, ways of doing things. And men talk about different things than do women. They don't talk about their feelings and relationships. They talk about things, whether it be politics or people or, in fact, rarely people, politics and sports, business and money. And listen to the way they speak and you'll see something very, very different. When Reuven begins speaking about whatever topic it is that he's informing his friend about, he's giving information, and his friend sits there like a domame, like a mute. Why? Because his friend is not sure whether he agrees or not. Reuven is giving over his opinion about politics or learning or business or money, whatever it is, and Shimon has to think whether he agrees. If he agrees, he'll say, yes, I see. If he disagrees, he'll say, I don't agree. But he's not going to just make noises along, because Shimon isn't trying to encourage Reuven to speak more. Reuven is divulging some important information. He's communicating his concepts, his ideas. If Shimon agrees, he'll make those noises. If not, he won't. Now, while this may seem interesting and irrelevant, this makes such a huge difference in a marriage that it's actually frightening to watch. What happens when a young couple gets married? So, as all couples do, they talk. The biggest complaint that women have, and ask marriage therapist after marriage therapist, the biggest complaint that women have is he doesn't listen. And she'll tell him, you're not listening. And he'll say, yes, I am. And he'll say, oh, word for word, what she just said. Why is that? The reason why is because she is sharing her world. She's trying to develop a closeness, bonding, and she's expecting words of encouragement of, really, tell me more. What do you mean? He is listening like a guy listens. When a guy listens to another guy, he's listening for information. Does he agree or does he not agree? And oftentimes, if he doesn't agree, he'll tell her right away. If he thinks she's wrong or she's exaggerating, or he'll make sure that she knows that she's really just making a mistake. And they're doing two opposite things in the same conversation. She's fostering a relationship, and he's involved in communication of ideas. And it's vastly different. The words may be similar, but the goals are vastly different. And if the couple don't understand their emotional differences, their emotional needs as being different, they're going to have a lot of friction. Because the primary method to building a relationship is talking, communicating my feelings, my sense of things. And the reason why women talk about trivial things that are irrelevant and don't matter is because they're not speaking about those things. They're speaking about their experiences, their feelings. They're sharing their day. They're sharing their life. They're not talking about the small minutiae that are being communicated. They're talking about them sharing their world and trying to bond. But men don't communicate that way. Men communicate in ideas and concepts. And when a man gets up and tells his wife about politics and his theories about whatever it may be, she's sitting back there saying, why is he lecturing at me? What is this, school? Why is he going on in this discourse, which is really irrelevant and boring? And if you think that guys complain that women talk about trivia, minutiae, and unimportant things, you'd better believe that many, many women think that their husband does much worse. Who cares who's in politics? Who cares about money? Who cares about the stock market? And you expect me to sit there and listen while you go on your tirade, you go on with your theories? And the reality is that men and women have very, very different roles and very, very different objectives, and they must learn the emotionalities and the needs of one the other. A man has to learn to listen. A man has to learn that his wife wants to communicate, not the facts, but her feelings, what she's going through. She wants to share her day. She wants to share her feelings because she wants to bond to her husband. She doesn't want criticism. She doesn't want good ideas. She doesn't want him to fix what's wrong with her. She wants a listening ear. And a man has to know that. And a woman has to recognize that when her husband doesn't provide that listening ear, she has to teach him what he's doing wrong. She has to, in a very calm voice, at a different time, say, dear, I just want to explain to you that, you know, when I talk to you a lot of times, I want to share my day with you. I want to share my feelings and my experience. And I don't feel that you're listening. I know you're listening, but I don't feel that you're with me sharing my day. And when a woman says to her husband, how was your day? What she's asking for is, be with me, bond with me. And a woman, as the relationship manager in the home, has to teach her husband how to bond. By and large, men don't have as much of a need, interest, or ability to form relationships as women do. The woman is the one, as the Akeres Abayis, who pulls the relationship together, who creates and keeps that relationship. And she has to teach her husband very carefully, very guardedly, because he does have a male ego that's very sensitive. But she has to explain her needs. What I need is for you to listen to me. And while a husband has to learn how to listen and a wife has to learn how to speak, the flip side of that is also true. A husband has to learn that when he listens, it's a good idea to do just that, to support. I see. And learn how to make the noises that women do. And a wife has to learn to recognize that when a husband doesn't do that, when a husband sits there as a mute, he's not a mute, he's listening. But he's a guy, and guys don't respond that way. And if both husband and wife focus on their differences, the different style of communication, the different needs in communication, what you'll find is it's a lot easier to be successfully married. One of the keys to a successful marriage, obviously, is communication. And a very interesting study proves that. One of the psychologists who was studying marriages made an interesting observation. He was a fellow in as a university position. He studied 264 different marriages. And he asked one question. The one question was, how significant do you rate communication in your marriage? How important is it? And what he found was almost every one of the women said it was the most important thing. And almost not a single one of the men said it. Why? Because by and large, men are happily married, doing things together, shopping, going, doing. But it's the woman who creates the relationship, who creates the bonding, who shares, who creates that sense of togetherness. And communication is the key for it. Most men don't need that. Most men don't recognize the importance of it. The woman, as the Akeres Abayis, is the one who demands it. She has to do it carefully. She has to do it kindly. And she is the one who is the glue of the emotional relationship. and communication is the key to it. One more step. In the 1960s, a new movement formed in America. It was called then women's liberation or feminism. Now, the basic concept began over 100 years earlier, when there were great debates: should women have the rights to own land, should women have the rights to vote. And there was slow progress where in the United States, women were given various rights. And there was a certain equality where women had effectively all the rights of men. But there was something lacking. And one of the most telling books of the time describes it. You see, in those times, let's take the 1950s in America. They were happy days. Most of the vets who came back from the war had married and settled down. They moved into suburbs, and they began their families. And if you can imagine, entire cities, villages and cities just forming anew, Levittown, tract houses with literally hundreds and hundreds of houses, all white picket fences, all neatly arranged, all the husbands going to work, the women staying home. And it was a very powerful sense of social order. A young woman coming of age in those times had one goal in mind: getting married and having children, raising a family. She took tremendous pride in that being her indispensable gift, to be the giver of life, maintainer of relationships. That defined her. 1963, Betty Friedan wrote a book called The Feminine Mystique. She had been a writer for one of the women's magazines, and she began a certain sort of quest, and she began writing a book. In the beginning of the book, she describes that there was a problem. The problem didn't have a name, and she didn't know what it was, and really no one knew what it was. But the more she got into it, the more she realized how big the problem was and how pervasive it was. And she goes on to describe that her friends were college-educated women, very intelligent, and they were being shackled. And they were being forced to spend their existence changing diapers and doing laundry, and they were being oppressed. And their whole sense of self was being stymied. And their whole sense of expression was being crippled because they weren't able to be who they were. And in her words, she writes, the traditional homes where wives were not employed were as comfortable as concentration camps. And that's how she viewed it. And this book, while only a part of it, was a seminal part of women's liberation. And from the 60s, America was gifted, Western society was gifted with a new concept: equality of gender. Feminism: women should be allowed to do man's jobs. Women should be allowed to work, to be lawyers and doctors and Indian chiefs, to be firemen, to be policemen. Why are women stymied? Why are they held back? Why aren't they allowed to express themselves? Why aren't women allowed to do men's roles? And as my wife says, the one irony of it is that feminism is actually masculinism, where women desire to be men. But you have to understand how far it went. Radical feminism of the 60s and 70s got to a point where, as a regular thought process, they declared war against the institution called marriage. Sheila Cruen, a member of the Red Stockings, wrote an essay, Marriage Declared. Radical feminists view marriage as an oppressive institution that harms women and children. Here's another quote. It became increasingly clear to us that the institution of marriage protects women in the same way the institution of slavery was said to protect blacks. Since marriage constitutes slavery for women, it is clear that the women's movement must concentrate on attacking this institution. And radical feminism declared war on marriage, on motherhood, on the entire concept of what a woman was. And they were hugely successful. Now, as I mentioned earlier, some of their points are valid, because from a Torah perspective, shkulimhem, a wife and a husband are equal partners. And if in Western civilization they viewed women as chattel, as servants, subservient, that was incorrect. And it could well be that some of this was corrective in a positive sense. But what came out of it in the 60s and the 70s was such a perversion that women began taking on the role of men, not just as breadwinner, but as the role of the man. And no longer was it that the woman was happy to stay home, happy to be a mother. She felt unfulfilled. She felt unsatisfied. And she needed to go out. And I remember vividly being a bacher in Beis Medrash in the early 80s. The yeshiva was next to a daycare center. And I watched these women come running early in the morning to drop off their children, their beautiful, precious possessions, drop them off in the care of some nunnery, I don't know what this was, some just, they put them on rows and just leave the kids there, while the woman went off to find fulfillment as a bank teller. And it was so sad to watch, because American people were sold a bill of goods. In the 1980s, if a woman was asked, what do you do? And she had to answer housewife, she was embarrassed. Housewife? You mean, you're not enlightened? You're not educated? Are you semi-retarded? Just a housewife? You mean you're satisfied just being home all day with your kids? And it was such a perversion in thought that men, women, society at large accepted the fact that to be fulfilled, a woman has to be working, has to have a career, has to be out there in the world. Now, I want to go on record as saying something very significant. If a woman feels that she needs more in her life, and she feels that she needs to do something else, leaving the house, having a career, or doing something else is a fine idea. But it doesn't define her. Glamour magazine in the United States of America is a corruption. A woman should be attractive. A woman should make herself attractive to her husband. Beauty is an integral part of a woman. But it doesn't define the woman, it's but a part. And if a woman feels that she'd be better out of the house for a certain amount of time, she'll be a better mother, a better wife, then it's a very good idea. Or if there are economic necessities that force her to take a job and sometimes work long hours out of the house, it's also a necessity. But it doesn't define the essence of who she was. And the resulting damage to society, the resulting damage to the family, is something that we today are still suffering. And we, as the Frum world, owe a great debt of gratitude and a tremendous sense of unglück, of impropriety, to this movement. You see, the reality is that we have a kollel society today. When a young man, a young woman gets married, they can learn for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years after they're married easily, because almost every woman accepts that working is part of her life. And in that sense, there's a big advantage, because it's a wonderful way to begin your marriage, husband learning, woman working, and in that sense, we owe a debt of gratitude to this feminist movement, and I doubt that Kola will be half as popular as it is now, if not for the fact that it's fully acceptable for women to work. But there's also a huge price that we pay, because a woman has forgotten her role in society. Even now, when there's been a backlash, and even now when women recognize that it's destructive to the family, there's still a certain sense of, I'm going to just be there with the kids all day. Am I fulfilled? Again, if a woman isn't fulfilled and she really needs it, there's nothing wrong with pursuing other things in addition. But understanding that the role of the woman is to be the wife, the mother, the one who nurtures, who cares, who's there, cares of bias, is fundamental to understanding a woman's role. And even now, we are still affected by these problems and these issues. And that's a very significant point. But I think that the feminist movement also cost us in a bigger way. And that is, men and women both forgot one of the key fundamentals to marriage. And that is exactly what the morale taught us, that a man and a woman are different, not casually, not insignificantly. They're opposites. Ezer kenegdo. It means that she's shukul and choshuv. She's as equal to the man, but it also means that she has a nature that's opposite her husband. And when a young couple gets married, they walk in assuming, look how alike we are. Look how similar we are. It's going to be beautiful. And then he realizes, and she realizes, that we're not quite alike. But it's not just that they're casually not alike. They have the opposite needs, opposite desires, opposite interests. They're about as unalike as you could ever imagine. And if you'd like to see the clearest illustration, look at any family before the children get married. You'll find many sisters are close. You could have sisters who are the best of friends. They're always together and talking, always together. You could even sometimes, not as often, but sometimes you have brothers who are very close. But it's very, very rare that you'll have a brother and a sister who are very, very close. Why? Because they're so different. I mean, they could like each other, be fond of each other, hold of each other, but close and sharing, very rare. And just watch in a family what happens. Men group with the men, women group with the women, because by and large, different interests, different desires, and different things that they're focused on. And when a husband and a wife get married, what they have to recognize is that they are vastly different one from the other. The way they communicate is different. The reason they communicate is different. The method of supporting is different. They have to learn one another, and they have to understand that communication is the key to a marriage. And when a woman desires to share, her husband has to learn to listen, and the husband has to learn to share his thoughts, his feelings. As the Chazon Ish says, when he leaves the house, he has to tell her where he's going, say where he came from, explain to her what his world is about, because he too has to learn together, they have to share, they have to build. What this morale is teaching us is something fundamental. When Hashem created Adam, Hashem created the perfect helpmate. But not perfect as an easy to just snap in and it's going to be great. It's an Ezer Kenegdo, equal, same level, but the opposite. If you have Hashem in your marriage, if Hashem is in your world, there's peace, and together the opposites join together. But you have to understand that you're opposites, and you have to understand how you have to relate one to the other. When Adam called his wife talker, it wasn't derogatory. It defined the essence of who she was. The reason why Hashem gave 9 measures of speech to women is because a woman is the one who builds the house, builds the relationships. The way you build a relationship is by communicating. She has a need to communicate, not to convey information, but to share, to bond. She's the one who pulls it together. She has to understand her role. Husband has to understand the role of the wife. And together they have to learn these things. Together they have to learn to communicate. When they do that, Hashem helps. They have a beautiful marriage. When they do this together, they have Shalom Bayis. May Hashem grant us the wisdom and the ability to put this into practice.